Well, Happy New Year. Wow. Are you already into the starting new things stuff, making all the resolutions, getting yourself off to a fresh start? New Year's a good time for that, and we're going to talk a little bit about maybe a different approach to that this morning. New Year's Day for us, for me, is a great holiday. I look forward to it. Every year, I just cannot wait. I'm buttering my wife up because it's not true. I love her family, but you know, on a day where really all men want to be doing one thing, and that is sitting and watching college football, they have decided that New Year's Day for my wife's extended family. And like, I grew up in a family where I had one aunt and one uncle. Neither one of them ever got married. No cousins. None. Okay? So we pretty much had holidays to ourselves. Her family, there are like 4.2 million people in her extended family. And they're all rednecks, every last one of them, you know. If you listen to the Jeff Foxworthy CDs, and you know, might be a redneck, that's her whole family. You know, you sit and listen, you're calling out names of people that are in her family that he is describing. But they've decided that New Year's Day is going to be their big Christmas holiday get-together. And so for the last 20 years, no college football on New Year's Day. Instead, I'm hanging out with people in houses that are like 82 degrees because everybody in our family has this weird temperature disorder. I'm like, seriously, put on a sweater or a coat, turn this down, I'm going to throw up. And then you go eat and it's a crazy day. And so we went over on New Year's Day and hung out there. We were at one of our, I hope nobody from your family listens online. But anyway, we may need to edit this part out. Anyway, we were over there, and we were at one of her cousin's house, and they got a lot more snow than we did over the last week, so they had, you know, a lot of snow on the ground. Of course, it was bitter, just brutal cold. And out in the front of their yard was this patch of ice. It was probably about 3 feet across by 4 feet wide, and it's just sitting there in the middle of the yard. And my son Josiah walks out, and he's kind of walking around the yard, checking it out, and he goes, "Ooh, an ice skating spot." And I'm just laughing. I'm like, ice skate, it's this big. And he starts to step on it. You know, he sees the ice. He's all excited. I'm going to ice skate. And he steps on the ice and he looks at me. And I said, "Josiah, be careful." And you know what he said, because every one of you who are parents have had your children do this. "I know, Dad." And he didn't get the words out of his mouth to where all of a sudden he was doing ch-ch-ch-ch-ch and feet are sliding and wham, down he went. And I just looked at it, I was like, "Yeah, you know." And for a second, I thought, you know, he was going to break into this. Aah! You know, he didn't. He kind of rolled over. And, you know, then he did the whole, you know, it looked like Bugs Bunny routine as he's trying to stand up on his ice and just falling down again and rolling. And finally, he rolled completely off the ice and got up. But I sat there and looked at him. And I thought, you know, that's hilarious, because that is us, okay? We live in a place and time where God is speaking into our lives going, "Let me talk to you." And we're like, "Yeah, we know. I know God. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know how to figure this thing out. I kind of got it handled." And we end up in the same place. We fall flat on our faces. And then New Year's comes around and it's like, okay, fresh start. I'm going to figure this thing out. I'm going to solve all my issues. And you know, most of us, we're like, "I am not going to eat in January. I ate enough in December to cover me through February, so I'm just not going to eat in January." And I used to like belong to a gym, and we bought a piece of fitness equipment since then. That sounds really bad. And when we lived in Baldwin, I belonged to the Point. I had to go in there in January, because in January it was packed. You could not get on a fitness machine in January. By February, you had them all to yourselves. It was no big deal. It's just kind of the way we work. And we look on TV, and January is a great time for all these commercials. Have you seen this, you know, this ab flexor thing where, you know, you put your knees on it and your body just does this while you're holding on to handles? And their commercial for that, it kills me. They show a guy who is shaped like me. Now, some people say that they have a six-pack. I've always said, six-pack, that's nothing. I have a Kager, okay? They're shaped like me, and this guy gets on this thing, and he's rotating his knees, and they say in 20 days on this thing, you can go from having this body. Next thing you know, this dude is like they showed us real quick metamorphosis. He is just lines, well-defined abdominal muscles, and he's skinny and he's buff. This flabby fat guy, just like that, 20 days. You get on this thing for 20 minutes a day. And I'm a 101.1 fan. I listen to sports radio way too much, okay? It probably needs to be one of my resolutions that I don't listen to sports radio quite as much as I do, but I do. And one of my favorite guys is on the afternoon on 101.1. His name's DeMarco Farr. He used to play for the Rams. He now is advertising this fitness place where if you will just go one time a week for 20 minutes, it will equal the workout anything else you do if you were to work out 30 minutes a day every day. Once a week for 20, we're like, yes, people will flock there. And he even says, tell them I sent you and I'll pay for your first lesson. And you know, in January, people are like flooding this place, writing checks for the first 6 months of going there. And they're gonna go for one 20 minute workout, pay for 6 months and never go back. Because that's the way we are, right? January is this nice, fresh start, chance to start anew. But there is something wrong with us, we know that, and we can't quite fix ourselves. We can't quite solve the person that we've become. And here's what my challenge for you this morning is, that there is a deeper issue, and it is the fact that we are created by God, for God, and more than just fixing our temporal kind of, whether it's I drank too much last year, or I ate too much, or I yelled at my kids too much and I kicked the dog too much, or whatever it is that our lives tend to be struggling with, and just saying, I'm gonna fix that. What we really need to do is come to a point where we really deeply encounter and wrestle with the God who made us and discover what his will for our lives is. Okay, so I've titled this talk, this message, How to Discover God's Will in 4 Easy Steps. Now, you got to know that's loaded, okay? I'm just telling you right up front, you're looking on the screens going, wow, 4 easy steps. It's loaded. It's a January 1st message. I'm kind of playing with the ab flexor thing. There's no easy steps. But what happens is in the book of Romans, Paul lays out for us and very clearly says in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, that we can know and experience the will of God. How, though? How can we, in this new year, as we're trying to start afresh, get beyond, I'm going to eat less, exercise more, and be a better person, too? 2010 for me is going to be about being really radically transformed and experiencing deeply the will of God in my life and his power and grace in everything I do. And so that's kind of my challenge for you this morning, that as we start a new year, what we really need is to discover God's will and to live in the middle of it. And what Paul does is he kind of lays this out for us. So if you have a Bible, go ahead and flip over there. If you don't have a Bible, on the end of your rows, we have Bibles for you. We would love for you to take one of those. We'll be on page 811 in one of those Bibles. Pass those down. Make sure everybody has a Bible and you're reading along with us. In Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, this is a letter written by a guy named Paul to a church that is in the city of Rome, the most influential city in the world. And as he writes this letter to these people, basically what he is doing is he is explaining to them the core issue of our faith, which is the gospel, the good news about Jesus. And verses 1 and 2 of Romans chapter 12 are what I will call a hinge verse. And I'll explain that in a minute, where he is gone from explaining a lot of stuff in very great detail, very deep doctrine, theology in the book of Romans. And in chapter 12, he goes from this is what God has done to now here's how we respond to that. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 are the hinge that goes from what God has done to how I respond to what God has already done. And the rest of Romans really is elaborating, explaining what chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 really mean. But chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 of Romans, Paul says this. He says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Look at that one line. He says that by testing you may discern, you may know, you may experience what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, perfect. We kind of live in a day and age where the dominant idea when people talk about religion is now nobody can really know who God is and what his will is. That it's really, we're just left to our best guess and we're all just speculating. We're just all hoping to figure out a little piece of God and have our own spirituality. But what Paul says here is Paul says, you can know, you can discern, you can experience God's will. And when you do, you will find that it's good. It's acceptable, meaning you will want what he is offering and it's perfect. Now, here's my question for you. 2010, it's a new millennium, depending on how you count. Some of you didn't catch it. You remember back in year 2000, everybody was like, new millennium, and there were a whole bunch of people who said, no, the new millennium begins in 2001 because we start with number one. Anyway, that's free. That meant nothing. But we're the 2010s. A new year. We want a fresh start. Would you like for 2010 to be the year where you discover what is good, what is pleasing and acceptable, what is perfect in your life? Paul says that we can experience that. And really, I mean, four easy steps. He just basically says, this is how you can know and experience and discover the will of God. And so what I want to do is I want to walk you through this text and show you what Paul says about knowing God's will. And he begins by saying to us, he begins by explaining to us that we need to remember God's mercy. We need to remember God's mercy. Chapter 12, verse 1, he says, I appeal to you, therefore. Now, let me teach you a principle of Bible reading, actually any literature. When you find a therefore, you should find out what it's there for. Therefore is one of those words that says, hey, something happened before this that what I'm going to say now, it's based on what I said before. And so when you see a therefore, you find out what it's there for. And he says, I urge you, I beseech you, I charge you, I challenge you by the mercy of God. What does he mean? And in a very clear, simple way, what he is saying is the rest of Romans is contingent on everything I said up to this point. So I've got to real quick explain Romans. And those of you who have been around church are like, oh my gosh, I have been in churches where the pastor preached on Romans for 8 years. How are you going to explain it in, we hope, 15 minutes? I won't even go that long explaining Romans. I may go longer than that, the whole deal, but explaining Romans. But let me just give you a brief overview of what Romans is about. In chapter 1, verses 1 through 16, Paul gives this great declaration. He kind of kicks it off. He greets the Roman church. He tells them that he loves them, and he tells them he wants to come visit them so that they will send him as a missionary to Spain. That's his goal. And he says, I want you to be a missionary sending church. And so he says, the declaration, chapter 1, verse 16, he says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation. That's the thesis statement of the book of Romans, that the gospel, the good news about Jesus, the story of the fact that God came and became a man and lived a perfect life and died on the cross in our place for our sin is the great story. And that story is the power of God for salvation. We are not saved at all by anything we do. It is solely because of what God has done by sending Jesus. The gospel is the good news. He says, I'm not ashamed of it. And then he begins to explain what this gospel is, but he starts with the bad news. And the rest of Romans chapter 1 to almost the end of Romans chapter 3, he basically lays out this argument that says we are all totally jacked up. We all, whether we're religious people or irreligious people, there is a core problem on the inside of us that makes us just ornery and evil and cantankerous, and we cannot fix it. We can't solve ourselves. We can't fix ourselves, no matter how hard we try. And some of us will run to religion. We're going to be a good person. But as we run to religion, we become prideful. We become arrogant. We become mean-spirited. We become just people who, in our goodness, because we don't drink, don't cuss, don't chew, don't date girls to do, we become the type of people that nobody wants to be around. And there's a ton of religious people on this planet who are the good people, and in their goodness, they're the worst kind of people to be around. And some of us, we fall to the side of freedom. We're just going to live our lives the way we want to. And we feel like if we just have some kind of measure of spirituality, we can do anything we want and God's going to be okay with this. But on the inside of us, there is a disconnect. There's a brokenness. There's a twistedness and we can't solve it. And in Romans chapter 3, Paul gives this link that he pulls a whole bunch of passages from the Old Testament that show us down deep in our heart of hearts how wicked and messed up we really are. And how if God doesn't step in and do something, we're hopeless. We like going to churches that pump us up, that build us up, that are like, you are wonderful and God loves you and let's build up your self-esteem. But Paul says the starting point of understanding the will of God and the gospel is to realize how desperately we need God to act on our behalf. And if we don't realize that, there's no hope. No hope. But the beginning in Romans chapter 3, the end of chapter 3, and for the rest of the book, Paul starts explaining this amazing, amazing plan of God where God sent his son to pay our debt, to give us hope, to make us alive spiritually. And when Paul says, I urge you therefore by the mercy of God, the mercy of God, he is referring to this great plan where God has given us what we don't deserve. He has done for us what we can't do for ourselves. He has offered something we could never obtain or earn on any level, his mercy, his grace. The gospel is a message of mercy. We don't deserve God to do anything on our behalf, and God has done everything. And there's a, you know, as you read through the book of Romans, there's a number of things that God tells us about his mercy, about what God's mercy has done to step into our lives. Ernest Hemingway wrote a short story, and in this short story, it's called The Capital of the World. He tells about a relationship between a Spanish man and his son. The son's name was Paco, and the son just kind of went off the deep end and broke the relationship with his father and just kind of ran off and made a total shambles of his life, totally rebellious, totally mess of his life. And he ran away from home. Paco's kind of a familiar Spanish name. It's kind of a name that a lot of kids had. And after a period of time, Paco's father, heartbroken at the condition that his son was in, decided he was going to go out and go on a search for a son. And he was going to reach out. When his son would never reach out to him, he was going to go out and reach out and try to find and rescue his son. And so he started traveling the streets, started going all over the place, started doing everything. He couldn't find him. And so finally he decided to take out an ad in the local newspaper, the Madrid newspaper, hoping that his son would see it. And the ad said this, "Dear Paco, please meet me in front of the newspaper office at noon. All is forgiven. Love, Dad." And as Ernest Hemingway tells the story, the next morning at noon, there were 800 young men named Paco at the office. The power of mercy. We don't search for God. We don't reach out to him. We are left in his state. And what the story of the gospel is that God is the Father who reaches out to us. We're Paco. And he says, all is forgiven. The cross has paid the debt. Mercy. And as you read the book of Romans, we find out that God, in his mercy, has done some things that even enables us to come to him. What we find out, first of all, is that the Bible teaches us that God chose us, that it is his mercy that draws us to himself, that God chose us. In Romans chapter 8, verses 29 to 30, it says, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified." Now, a lot of big words in there, but here's the baseline deal. It says that when we could not reach out to him, God stepped into our lives and reaches out to us. That before the creation of the world, that God settled in his sovereign purpose to make a difference in the lives of people. Now, I'm telling you, when you start reading the Bible and you come across words like election, predestination, they're hard. I'm not trying to like open a can of words, but this is what I want to tell you this morning. I want you to understand that God reaches out to you before you ever reached out to him. That God has, in his grace and in his perfection and in his love and in his sovereignty, has done something by choosing us, by reaching out and calling us to himself. I will never forget Mr. Christensen. I can't remember the names of most of my teachers growing up, but I will never forget Mr. Christensen. First of all, he was the only guy teacher I had, like, so that was kind of cool. Fifth grade, Mr. Christensen wore wingtip shoes, had kind of red hair, had horrible breath. Like, you were like sitting in your desk, and when he would come up and like help you, you would be like, I have to get this right. I gotta know my math, because if I don't, he's gonna hover over me and help me and I will pass out. This is Mr. Christensen, okay? But every day at recess, we would go out and out to our recess, and the thing that Mr. Christensen loved to do with his class, especially the guys in his classes, he loved to play football. And we would go out, and we would hang out in the blacktop on days where it was raining, or even go out to the field, and we would play touch football, the whole class. And there were two ways that Mr. Christensen would play. One way is he would just kind of divide us up, and he would be the all-time quarterback, and he would just always throw, and we'd all play, and he was real good about throwing the ball to all the kids. But some other days, he would go out there, and he would choose to choose a team and play against another group of kids that were in the class. And, you know, when I got into high school, I got a little bit athletic and did play baseball and basketball and all that stuff. But when I was in fifth grade, I was shaped pretty much like I am now. And I was the slow, fat kid, okay? I was not the kid who was going to beat the kid, you know, the guy down the catch a pass, running for a touchdown, spike the ball. I was not the one, like, when it was time for choosing, I was not the one where everyone went, oh, I want Hubbard first. You know, I was a kid who kind of sat there like, somebody choose me, please. I want to be on your team. And, you feel like nobody really wants you. You feel kind of dejected with, you know, when all of a sudden they're picking girls. You're like, seriously. And the cool thing about Mr. Christensen is when he built a team, you know what he always did? He chose the fat kids and the slow kids first. He made me a part of his team. But because he was a quarterback and he was playing against some fifth grader that he could, you know, always intercept the pass himself and all that, we always won. And so we would come in from lunch with all the athletes, you know, all the kids who were like, you know, I'm going to be the all-state, you know, and you look at them and you're like, I wish I could run like that kid. I wish I could catch like that kid. You know, they're the kids where you go, you know, to PE class and they have the Presidential Medal of Fitness and their names are in big, bold letters. And then the kids who didn't pass any of the tests down at the bottom, little bitty letters, Hubbard, you know. And he chose me. And we won and it was beautiful and I loved him for it. Listen, we're the little fat kid. We're the people who, we can't do it. And I want to let you know that the Bible is like crazy clear, and I don't get, it's hard to balance. Yes, there is freedom and responsibility in humanity. I get that. The Bible teaches that. But the Bible also teaches very clearly that in God's love, he chose me. And that is an act of his mercy. And I love him for it. I love him for it. It also teaches, as Paul's explaining the mercy of God in the book of Romans, he teaches us that is the mercy of God that forgives us. In Romans chapter 5, verse 1, he says, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Justified is a word that means that God looked at our guilt and wiped it clean. Peace means that God built the bridge of relationship again. And this is the picture. We don't deserve, I mean, we have a broken relationship with God and we are totally messed up, totally guilty before God. But because of Jesus and out of God's mercy, God has chosen to wipe the slate clean for people who trust Jesus. He has chosen to wipe the slate clean and see us as if we've never sinned. And he has rebuilt the bridge of relationship so that we can have peace with God. The mercy of God forgives us. And Romans also teaches us that the mercy of God is what changes us. Romans chapter 5, verses 17 through 19. He says, for if because of one man's trespass, he's talking about Adam, the original man, through that man's trespass, that man's sin, death reigned through that one man. Much more will those who receive the abundance of grace, that's the flip side of mercy, grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in this life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Therefore, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all men. In other words, what Paul is saying is that we are born in a situation where we're like the first father, Adam. We all are sinners and we're all just trapped. We can't undo this. But then Christ died for our sins and he lived the perfect life. And now when we have Jesus, he comes in our life and he transforms us so that we're alive. And that life empowers us to live the way God wants us to live. And so even growth, even change in our life, it's the result of God's mercy. And here's the deal. If you want to know and live in the will of God, it starts with realizing everything in life for a person who is a follower of Jesus is a result of the mercy of God. I can't, he did. His mercy invades my life and changes me. Now, a lot of you come to this service and you're just kind of seeking, you're just kind of checking Christianity out, you're not sure about this thing, and you're like creating a religious system where if I do this, this, and this, God will be okay with me. The starting point of knowing the will of God is when I just put my arms down and go, I'm worse than I ever imagined. But Jesus chose me, forgives me, and changes me anyway. And I look to Jesus who died on the cross and trust him. That's what Christianity is. It is a giving up of my own attempt and falling at the mercy of Jesus, which he gives freely. And the starting point, the first step is not only as a person who is seeking faith, but even if you're in here and you're a follower of Jesus, our tendency is to grow a little bit and then we pat ourselves on the back and go, look at me, it's 2010 and I'm a better Christian than I was in 2009. Yes! And we get prideful. And we got to fall back and say, anything that I am today is a result of the mercy of God in my life. That's it. Mercy. The second thing Paul wants to say to us then is he says, first of all, we need to find mercy. Second, we need to relinquish management. We need to relinquish management. Look at chapter 12. He says, to present your bodies as living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. He says, the next thing we need to do is we need to give up ownership or management of our lives. We need to come to the point where we live our lives as a living sacrifice. Now, this is language that refers to the Old Testament in the Bible where there were sacrifices made on a regular basis. And the idea is that you would take an animal or something and you would lay it on an altar. And what Paul is saying is that the will of God is not a roadmap, it's an altar. See, what we want is we want the will of God to be like a Google Maps, right? You do this, you're like, you gotta drive somewhere, and so you're like, you open up the map and you say, Google, oh almighty Google, tell me how to get there, right? And you put point A and point B and you click and it gives you this map and it shows you, it even has nice purple lines to take you across the roads. But now, women don't do this, okay? I get this, but men do. Men look at the map that Almighty Google gives us and we go, but I know a shortcut. I have a better way. If I go this way, it will get there quicker. And never mind that when Google charts that map out, it goes from 2 hours and 11 minutes to 2 hours and 45 minutes. We know that if we will take this shortcut, we will get there. And this is what most of us feel about the will of God. We say, God, here's what I want to do. I want you to lay out a roadmap and show me in 2010, what are the things that I need to do to get there? And we hope that God will show up and give us this nice, neat, little, tidy map. But then what we do, if God were to give us, if out of heaven today, you were to go home and go, God, I want to know your will. And boom, right out of the chandelier in your dining room, this thing dropped and said, here it is. Here is God's will. We would start reading that and go, well, I see this, God, but I have a better way. I can get to this place in my life quicker if I'll do this. I mean, you know you would do that. I would do it all the time. And what Paul says is we need to quit saying the will of God like a roadmap, and we need to see it as an altar, a place where we just crawl up and offer all of me. He says, I urge you to present your body. I look at that and I go, God, you don't want this thing. But Paul says, that's me. That you crawl on an altar and you give yourself away. That's the will of God. It's not a roadmap. It's a surrender of all of me to all that he is. And I totally give myself away. It's not, God, give me a list so I can do the things I need to do. While I do the things I need to do, I'll also jump in a few things that you want for me. It is coming to the cross and seeing that Jesus gave himself away. And the call to not be a dead sacrifice, to be a living sacrifice. That I still have life, but that life is no longer mine. I crawl on an altar and give myself away. And you know what the hardest part for a living sacrifice is? Every morning, a living sacrifice wants to crawl off the altar. Every morning, a living sacrifice wants to go about its own way, do its own thing. But to experience and know the will of God, 2010, here's what you have to figure out. You have to figure out what it looks like in your life to surrender all of you to the purpose and plan of God, to his goodness and his mercy in your life. You have to give up ownership. You have to give up management. You have to say, I'm no longer the boss of me. My life is not my own. I've been bought with a price. And I glorify God with all that I am. As long as we as people, and I'm standing up here telling you that as I've kind of wrestled with this text and decided to preach this, this is for me, okay? This is not for you primarily. I need to hear this again in my life because as much as I love the holidays are time where I crawl off the altar in a lot of areas of my habits and discipline and ideas. And the life of the gospel is a life where I give up management. I relinquish control of my life. The third thing Paul says, the third step, first of all, we need to live in God's mercy. We need to relinquish our management. We need to be people who live life on an altar that God has created in our lives where we give ourselves away. The third thing is we need to reject the mold. Verse 2 says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He says, we need to reject the mold. And what Paul is getting at here is he's saying, for people of faith who have experienced the mercy of God, we live in a world that wants to shape us, that wants to form us. The word do not be conformed is a word that literally means don't be pressed into the mold. I had my wife bring up here for me Play-Doh. Did anybody give Play-Doh for Christmas this year or Play-Doh molds? Tons of blue Play-Doh. All right, we take this Play-Doh and we play with it and we form it and we shape it and we may even get a Play-Doh waffle iron because in America, we even want our toys to remind us that we're ready to eat. So now I have taken and by the pressure applied with my Play-Doh waffle iron, I have a Play-Doh waffle. It looks good enough to eat, although it's blue. I'm not sure we want to. Although, did you used to love eating Play-Doh when you were a kid? I won't do that this morning because I'll freak you out. Anyway, the mold has shaped the pliable Play-Doh, okay? And this is what God is trying to teach us, what Paul's trying to say to us, that we live in a world that's always trying to shape us into a mold. It's trying to force us into a place. And that place sometimes is a place where it is values and ideas that actually are contrary to what God has revealed and taught about himself. Other times, it's just values and ideals that are just apathetic to God. But the world is always trying to shape us. And what we need to do in our lives is not run from the world and become like we form a commune and we all get together and sing weird songs and light campfires and never get exposed to anything in the world. But what we have to do is we have to live our lives so that we are constantly making sure we're not being shaped and formed by the world around us that does not believe in Jesus and does not hold on to the things of God, all right? And he says, we need to be people who are not shaped, who are not formed, who are not put into the mold of the pattern of this world. What are some of these things? There's an economic mold in our world. In our culture, we did this all through Christmas. That economic mold is driven by materialism, the drive to have more and more and more stuff, bigger cars, better jobs, more money. And we tend to get forced into that, think, man, that's what life's all about. There's even a theology. We turned on the TV this morning and listened to the most popular preacher in North America stand on the stage and tell 20,000 people in his church that the goal of your spirituality is that you will close your eyes and imagine owning mansions and cars. And if you will just imagine these things, God will do it for you. That's not the gospel. The gospel says I crawl on an altar. The gospel says I deny myself and follow Jesus, not that I live so that I can have more and more stuff. That's the mold. It's just spiritualizing the mold. There's priorities mold that live for yourself. Seek number one. You are the ultimate. There's mold that the world shapes for us in the areas of morality. We watched a movie. We enjoyed it. I mean, I'm not saying, like, don't be. Like, these movies are evil. It's just the way the world thinks, and that's okay. It's who they are. They don't know Jesus. They haven't experienced the mercy of God. But we watched The Proposal. Cute movie, kind of hokey in places. If you've seen it, I hope you enjoyed it. If you didn't, take your poison. I don't care. But it was very interesting in the movie how the movie just assumed the whole, everybody in the movie just assumed that people who are going to get married are already living together. And I was reading this week about a church. Let me say it again. I was reading this week about a church who has decided to hold pre-marriage ceremonies to endorse people who want to live with each other for a year or two before they get married. And what they said is they see themselves as married already. They see themselves as married, get married. But God's plan is one man, one woman together for one lifetime. And what that church is, the mold is, the culture just says, that's no big deal. The gospel says that when we've experienced God's mercy, we can't be conformed in that. Now, hear me, I'm not saying it's therefore don't watch the movies. I'm saying reject what they try to force. Is the world around us who doesn't know God tries to have ideas. We need to be a people who don't let that shape us and form us completely. Reject the mold. And then the last thing that Paul says, the last step here that he kind of lays out is not only do we experience the mercy of God and give up our own management, that we live on the altar, not only do we not keep ourselves from being pressed by the mold, but we renew, you need to renew your mind. That's the fourth step. That he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And let me just simply explain to you what Paul is saying is that we will be shaped and molded by something. The question is, what will shape and form us? What is going to mold our character and our lives? And for a follower of Jesus, it is very simple that if we want to know and experience the will of God, we have to have the intake of the Bible as a large portion of who we are. The way that our minds are renewed, are shaped, are formed by God and his purpose is that he speaks through the scriptures into our lives. Now here, just bottom line reality. 2010, gonna be a year where you experience the will of God. There's no way it will happen unless we become people who start reading the Bible. Searching through the scriptures, figuring out what God has said. For far too many of us, our experience with the Bible and having God renew our minds is once a week, some dude standing on the stage for way too long screaming at you. And listen, I know that my wife, you went too long, and I have people all around remind me, hey, you're too long. But here's what's really crazy about this. One guy stand up for 50 minutes, and that's kind of all the intake we get, and people won't even come back sometimes because I go too long. And we average, 15, 18 hours a week watching TV? And that's the only spiritual intake a lot of people will ever get on a weekly basis. And then we wonder at the end of 2010, when it's over, why is my life no different? And the reason is because we are not letting our hearts and our minds, our beings be shaped by what God has said and who he is. And so how do we do that? We just start reading through this Bible. Now, real quick, if you've never read the Bible before, let me tell you where to start. Start with the book of Mark in the New Testament. Next week, I'm going to actually explain how to read the Bible as part of my sermon next week, okay? So I'm going to take you to the table of contents, explain the whole thing. I don't want to jump into that this morning because that's part of next week's message. But the book of Mark in the New Testament was written by a young man whose name is John Mark, who was like a disciple, a young man who followed this guy named Peter, who was one of Jesus' best friends. And Mark writes down the memoirs of Peter about the life of Jesus. And it is a short, fast-paced, interactive gospel story about Jesus that it just explains the simple life of Jesus and basically more than his teachings, it's what Jesus did, the events of his life. That's the place to start. If you've never read the Bible before, start reading through the book of Mark and make it your goal. This January, I am going to get through the book of Mark. And then from there, pick up something else. There's all kinds of resources. I'm going to try to, this week, find my blog and download or link to some Bible reading plans if you want to find a plan that is for you. But start downloading the Bible into your life. And that's how you know and experience the will of God. You remember God's mercy. It's never me. It's always him. I am at his mercy. It's I give up myself. I'm not looking for a roadmap. I crawl on an altar. I reject the fact that the world is always trying to shape me and form me, and I am rejecting that saying, I need to be shaped and formed by something different. What I'm going to be shaped and formed by is the word of God, the scriptures, and I will have my mind renewed. And here's what Paul says. Paul says very clearly that when that happens in your life, you will be able to discern what the will of God is, and you will find it to be good, acceptable, and perfect. That's how January 1st, Sunday 2010, you can look forward to 1st Sunday 2011 and say, it was a great year because I met God deeply and he has changed me. That's my hope for you. That's my challenge for you this morning. And I hope you'll kind of look at this and go, there's where it is. I would encourage you, Romans 12, 1 and 2, memorize those two verses and make that the mantra of your life this year. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to sing and celebrate Jesus, because our response to every sermon, every time we hear somebody stand up here and open the scriptures and talk to us, our response, including mine, is to say, Jesus, you are wonderful. You are great. We love you. We give ourselves to you. And so we're going to sing and celebrate Jesus as a response. As we do that, we're going to collect an offering. And if you're a guest, we are not asking you, nor do we expect you to give. This service is our gift to you. But for those who are part of Genesis, our giving of an offering is a response to say, the world tells us get more and more and more. We are going to give more and more and more. I am so excited that we as a church, Advent Conspiracy Offering, we collected over $4,000. It's awesome. But we need to keep that. And a giving of an offering is a way for us to say, we love Jesus, we're giving back, okay? And so that's an act of worship. We're gonna sing, we're gonna take up an offering, we're gonna celebrate, and we're gonna respond to what God has said. We want to know the will of God. It's not easy steps, you know that, but there are ways that you and I can experience the word of God, the will of God in our lives this year. Jesus, we love you, I praise you, and I just ask you to change us, to challenge us, to shape us, to form us. We don't wanna be trapped in the mold of what this world has to offer when you are a great God. And so I pray that we would find the will of God, you would show it to be good, acceptable, and perfect in our lives, and you would change us this morning. In your name I pray, amen.